It's Kerrang Radio. It's the night before. My name's Nick Majerison. I'll be absolutely honest with you. I'm really nervous and excited.
Everything's fine. No big deal.
Man, you... Wait a minute. Listen, let me explain. Right. With us, we have a guy, right, who... Dr. Ed Mitchell, right? And he's a bloke who's walked on the moon. That's who he is. And what I'm going to do is I'm going to chat to him, and we'll see how long I can go without mentioning the fact that he walked on the moon. Dr. Ed Mitchell, how's it going?
Everything's fine this morning, Nick, thank you.
You walked on the moon!
Once upon a time.
Don't you, man, I imagine the novelty's worn off for you.
I bet.
But you walked on the moon, you were there. You know, the moon that everyone looks at. And, like, throughout all of human history, every single important historical figure in the world has gazed up in wonder at the moon, and you have walked round on it.
True.
That must be the most incredible, bizarre, insane thing in the world.
Well, I think it was a natural progression of our human explorations. My parents' generation started exploring in aircraft, and our generation started exploring in spacecraft. So it's just a natural extension of what we humans do.
Listen, let me get some detail here. So January the 31st, 1971, you set off on your journey into outer space, right?
Right.
And what did it feel like, right? When, I mean, obviously you were involved in NASA already, but what did it feel like when you were selected to go to the moon?
I had started out to make that happen in October of 1957 when Sputnik went up. And I realized humans would be shortly behind that. And I got some extra education, did my test pilot duties for a while, and eventually was selected in 1966 into the Apollo program. And was selected for a crew status a couple of years after that. So that was pretty nice stuff.
I'm trying to picture, was it a phone call or a meeting or, you know, the moment when you knew you were going to be going towards the moon?
Being selected into the program, which was the first step, was a phone call.
You must have had people in your life who will have just been frightened that you were going to die.
Well, certainly there was risk involved, but I was a test pilot, and I'd been in war, I'd been in the Korean War, and that isn't particularly a safe thing to do.
How seriously did you consider the possibility that you might die?
Oh, well, you have to get rid of that early in the game, or you're not worth anything in the flying game or in the military at all. You have to come to terms with that.
So you're on board that rocket, right? You're there, and it's starting to take off, and it's juddering about, and it's, you know, all of that kind of stuff. What's your main job whilst all that's happening? What are you doing whilst they're doing the countdown and everyone else is watching you?
You're watching the gauges in there, make sure everything's going along fine, and then you continue to do that. I mean, that's your job. You're flying a machine, and it had a crew of three, and we had quite a few people on the ground doing the same thing, so you had to learn to do the teamwork, and that's what the show is teamwork. Busy, you're flying a machine, you've got responsibilities. Your responsibilities increase enormously after you've made the trip to the moon, and you're in orbit, and then you're really having to go down to the surface and get to work. But you're still flying a machine at that point. Hmm.
Did you ever get a chance, whilst you're on the way there, to just relax and enjoy yourself?
Well, of course, we had our sleep periods. We had our off-duty periods, but by and large they were to have meals, to give a little rest and relaxation, try to sleep, but always somebody was on duty. It's like on boarding aboard a ship. You have to have a crew working all the time, and you do it in shifts, and then when it comes time to make a maneuver, we have all hands at their stations and doing what they have to do.
Were you counting down the time, whilst you were on board that spaceship, were you counting down the time until you were going to get to hang out on the moon?
Well, we had a clock doing that for us. We had a timeline. We knew exactly where we were in the process, what was the next step, what we had to do next. So we practiced and practiced and practiced each one of the steps that we had to go through. So it was a well-rehearsed operation.
I'm picturing you sort of nudging your mate going, hey, it's only 10 minutes, then we'll be on the moon.
No, frankly, you're much too busy going through checklists. It's very operational at that point. You've got to be more methodical than that.
Now, if you're part of the Apollo 14 mission, then you'll have been thinking to yourself about the previous mission that hadn't gone so well, right?
That is quite true. You see, the previous mission was initially our mission. And so it, as it, things turned out, we got a good machine and our predecessors got a bad machine. That's the luck of the draw here.
Mm. So how does it work? You're on board your rocket. Do you get onto the lunar lander, I guess, and talk me through that. Or is the lunar lander part of the rocket? I've never quite understood how that bit
works.
Well,
there's really two different spacecraft. One of them is, there's actually several parts to it. The part that is the lunar module or the lunar spacecraft itself is a separate spacecraft. And one of us, the so-called command module pilot, stays in lunar orbit in the mothership, the command module, while two of us went down to the surface in the lunar module, which is was designed just for landing and then getting off and getting back into orbit to rendezvous with our teammate there. We were down on in our particular mission. We were gone for almost 2 days, but we were on the surface for 34 hours.
Wow. I mean, am I right in thinking that you actually hold the record for the longest ever moonwalking session?
Well, that's not quite the case. We made the longest trek on foot. The later missions, everyone stayed longer, built on the successes of the past. But they also had the lunar rover, which is the little electric car that they used to get around, so they could go further than we had. We could go, but they got to ride instead of walk. We had the longest on foot trek in the lunar surface, in which we had to go on foot 2 kilometers away from our spacecraft and climb up a crater slope to sample, get rocks and things from all along the way up to the top of that crater called Cone Crater.
So did you know before you landed exactly whereabouts on the moon you were going to land?
Oh, we knew precisely where we were going to land. See, we did things by step. Let me take you through it. The Apollo 10 mission went to the moon and did everything but land. They practiced every maneuver. It was a dress rehearsal for the lunar landing. Then the Apollo 12 mission, their job was to prove that we could land precisely where we wanted to land on the lunar surface and get off safely. And then the third mission, which was the ill-fated Apollo 13, didn't make it, so we had to take up and do that job. We flew their mission. So our job was to start to do useful science on the moon and to do exploration of the moon, to begin that. So each mission extended what we knew and what we could do a little bit further than the past one. And each mission built upon the successes of the last till the Apollo 17, which was the last one, had the longest stay time and went into the most rugged terrain of any of the flights. We kept building it up, making it more difficult, more challenging, and getting deeper into the surface as we did that.
When you actually get out, and you've landed, you get out, and you're on the moon. Did you worry, with everybody watching you, that you were just going to lose it?
Oh, heavens no.
There must have been part of you when you were on the moon that was thinking to yourself, I hope my ex-girlfriend sees this.
No, I'm sorry. That isn't us at all. We were devoted to the task at hand, and we focused on the task at hand, and all of us were far more disciplined than that.
When you were there, roughly how far can you jump when you're on the moon? Can you, how far compared to how you can normally jump?
Well, not very far, although it's a good thought, simply because the pressure suit is so cumbersome and stiff, and I tell the children that always ask about things like that, that it's like walking around with your mama putting 2 snowsuits on you, but you're walking on a trampoline, so that you have a kind of spring in your step due to the reduced gravity. But that's kind of the feel. That's like walking around with, like a human, like an adult with 2 overcoats on, but you're still walking on a trampoline, or you got springs in your shoes or something like that.
As you're wandering around on the very surface of the moon, how deep is the dust? Is it muddy or is it hard like a rock floor?
The surface on the front side where we landed is very dusty. It's about the consistency of talcum powder, but it's basalt. It's lunar rock, and it's volcanic rock that has come out of the inside of the moon and filled the craters on the front side over the billions of years of existence, and then been pummeled and beaten up by meteor impacts and asteroid impacts and little particle impacts till it's the consistency of very fine talcum powder and very clingy, very electrostatic, so that it sticks to your garments and everything. It's kind of tedious to get off, to get yourself cleaned off a bit before you go back in the spacecraft. But that's what you have to do. Otherwise, you track it all back in the spacecraft, and it becomes a real obnoxious mess. It's estimated in many places to be about 30 meters thick, this so-called regolith, that surface dust layer that's packed in like sand on a beach.
Fine. What of the whole experience whilst you were there, and whilst you travelled there, is the one sort of thing that always, you know, is in your mind whenever you think about it?
Well, the most impressive thing of all for me in coming back was seeing Earth from space and getting a chance to see the magnificence of the heavens and see this tiny little planet and see the Earth, the Moon, the Sun, and the stars in the proper perspective of being celestial bodies, and our little planet as being one of them, way out on the spiral arm of our galaxy, and our solar system is kind of about two-thirds of the way out from the center of our galaxy. And so it's interesting to take a look at all that and put it into that perspective.
Do you ever dream about it?
Well, in the past, but I, not anymore. I don't do that. I don't really do that anymore.
When the thing landed, right?
Yep.
How surprised would you have been when you got out onto the moon if you'd have bumped into E.T.?
Oh, well, that wasn't going to happen. We knew our job better than that, and we knew the surface better than that. That simply wasn't going to happen.
Would have been surprised, though, wouldn't you?
Well, I think, yes, we would have been surprised, because there's nothing in the books that would have prepared us for that, and quite the contrary, of course.
It would have been amazing, though, had that happened. It's one of those things that I've always thought, that, you know, you're going to totally uncharted territory, you land there, you get out, and you see, like, someone walking around already, or maybe like a UFO flying around, and you'd be like, oh.
Well, we'd be surprised by something untoward, such as aliens walking around the surface when we got there.
That would be a strange way of making first contact for them, wouldn't it? Now you've been to the moon, and you know, you've done all these incredible things. Has it given you a different perspective on things like, you know, aliens and UFOs and that kind of stuff?
Well, of course, you have a different perspective. I call it the big picture point of view. I had a very powerful experience coming back, just observing all of this, and recognizing that the molecules of my body were manufactured in some ancient generation of stars, which is, you know, our current theory of how star systems form the matter of the universe, the material, the atomic structure and the molecular structure. And that makes up our bodies and our cars and our buildings and our Earth and everything else. And that comes out of star systems. And recognizing that that was a source of the matter in my body was, suddenly, instead of an intellectual knowledge, which I learned in astronomy class doing my doctoral work, it was a visceral experience, an inner experience that was very interesting and surprising. I'd never had that type of experience before, but it is the experience of discovery, of seeing something new and the big picture and seeing things in a new context. And many of us had that type of experience of seeing upon looking at Earth and the heavens from space and seeing it in a new way is quite a revelatory experience.
Really? So you're coming back from the moon and you had some sort of, like, a spiritual awakening on having seen the Earth in its perspective and...
Well, it's called an epiphany, yes, something like that. Mm-hmm.
Whoa! So what is that a religion? Are you a religious person now, or?
Oh, no, it's a little more profound than that.
Do you believe in God?
Well, probably not in the same way that traditional religions do, but certainly the fact that the universe is an intelligent, creative organism and a system, for me and for many of us, the traditional answers don't hold. So you have to go further than that.
Do you believe in life on other planets?
Yes. There's not much question at all. But there's life throughout the universe. We're not alone in the universe at all.
You're convinced that we're not alone in the universe?
Oh, I know for sure we're not alone in the universe. Now, have we been able to identify for sure where the other planets are? No, we have not. Certainly not in our solar system. But they've identified quite a number of planets now that very likely could be life-bearing planets. And I happen to be privileged enough to have be in on the fact that we have been visited on this planet. And the UFO phenomenon is real, although it's been covered up by our governments for quite a long time.
Whoa! Hang on a minute. Well, this is big. All of this is quite a shock to me.
Well, I'm sorry. You haven't been reading the papers recently. It's starting to open up quite a bit.
So you're telling me... Well, there's a lot of information to take on board. Hang on a minute. Listen, I've heard, crazy UFO nuts tell me this kind of thing before. I've never had Dr. Ed Mitchell, the sixth man to walk on the moon, a respected scientist in his own right, announce to me that we've been visited by aliens from other planets and that they definitely are out there. There's no debating it.
Well, that's the first time you've ever talked to me, or I've told you about it before.
So you believe the whole deal?
There's more nonsense out there about this than there is real knowledge, but it is a real phenomenon, and there's quite a few of us. It's been well covered up by all of our governments for the last 60 years or so, but slowly it leaks out, and some of us are privileged to have been briefed on some of it. I happen to have grown up in whether you know this place, Roswell, New Mexico, where presumably the Roswell incident of 1947 took place, and I'm quite knowledgeable of the lore there, and since I grew up there. But I've also been in military circles and intelligence circles that knows beneath the surface of what has been public knowledge that, yes, we have been visited.
So, and be serious, you're not going to go... You know, I was just pulling your leg about that. That's not true. I'm just wondering if I've stumbled upon astronaut humour, and in a couple of minutes you're going to go, I was only pulling your leg.
No, I won't say that.
Wow. So you've been briefed on the fact that there are we've been visited.
Well, I have briefed is one word for it. I have been involved in. Much of this work, it's not my main work, it's not my main interest, but I have been deeply involved in certain committees and certain research programs with very credible scientists and very intelligence people that do know the real inside story, and I am not hesitant to talk about it.
What is the real inside story?
Well, I've just been telling you, we have been visiting.
Are we in regular contact, or was it a one-off crash, or...
Well, no, there's been quite a bit of contact going on. I can't tell you because I don't know all the extent of it. I don't know all the inside details because that isn't my really main interest. But the fact that we have been visited, the Roswell crash was real, and a number of other contacts have been real and ongoing, is pretty well known to those of us who have been briefed and been close to the subject matter.
So why... Is it being covered up, then? Why is it that it's not mainstream?
Well, the reason for that goes back to the main instance really started taking place after World War II, when in the United States, at least, I can't speak for the European government or the South American governments, all of whom have recently started opening their files. And this is starting to open up, and just read the Internet or look at some of the press, international press, you'll start to get the stories that are coming out now.
But I've had people on the show telling me that that the governments are mounting up towards disclosure, towards saying that this is the case. Do you think it will be the case that there will be an actual disclosure on this, maybe this year, that the governments will come out?
I don't know whether it will be this year in the United States, but certainly we've already had it in the last few years from the Belgian government, the French government, the Brazilian government, the Mexican government. They've opened their files and admitted that they had the files.
Okay, let me get my head together. Okay, listen, here's what I know. I've had people on the show talking about the fact that the Catholic Church has said belief in life on other planets doesn't compromise your Catholicism.
Of course, that just happened recently.
Yeah.
In association with a major release, I believe, of the British government, some of the British government files. They weren't their deepest files, but there were some files released.
Yeah. What's happening is, at the moment, over the next 4 years, all of the UFO files here in the UK are being released. Do you think it's the case that we are ramping up towards maybe the UK admitting?
Well, I can't say how fast this is going to happen, but certainly the public awareness of it is increasing. The public acceptance is increasing. The amount of misinformation and covert and attempts to cover up seem to be decreasing. I think we're headed toward real disclosure, and some very serious organizations moving in that direction.
You've had a long time to think about this. What do you think the impact will be on the world when it is finally mainstream news that there are alien beings that live outside this planet?
Well, I think at this point it's probably ho-hum, so what's new? I think that certainly in the United States, there's well over 70% of the people now accept this as fact, although they may not, they do not know the all the correct story. They do know that there has been, or accept the fact that there has been visitation and that there's UFOs in the skies all the time that are very likely alien craft. Now, not all of them are. I suspect some of them are homegrown. I suspect that in the last 60 years or so, that there has been some back engineering and the creation of this type of equipment, but it's not nearly as sophisticated yet as what the apparent visitors have.
So, as part of this, as part of you knowing about this, and also going public with it, are you worried for your own safety with this kind of stuff, or are you convinced that the conflict...
No, I think those days are gone. That used to be a concern among the people on the inside, but I don't think they're knocking anybody off for that anymore or doing drastic things to them.
What do you think the intent of the aliens is? Is it hostile or peaceful?
No. It's not hostile. It's pretty obvious that if it were hostile, we'd have been gone by now.
Really? I mean, what?
We could have been.
Wow.
We had no defense, if that's what their real intent was.
And what are we talking, what do they look like? Are we talking like, you know, the traditional
sort
of...
You've seen some of the pictures that I know of. Some of them are these little people with strange, that look strange to us. As far as I know, from my contacts that have had contact, that's pretty accurate.
Wow. Do you think other people who were involved in the moon landings know about this?
Some of them do. But again, it's like other people. If you're interested enough to dig into it and want to know about it, you can know about it.
Because, man, listen, I know you're a busy guy, and I know there's other people who need to...
Yeah, this phone, that's not leaving me alone with this other phone that's ringing all the time, and I'm by myself here.
This has been easily one of the most significant conversations of my life. Unbelievable. I want to thank you for joining us.
You bet.
And Dr. Ed Mitchell, listen, you're a friend of the show, if you want to accept that friendship. Wow, what an incredible conversation. Listen, man, thanks for joining us.
I'm glad you enjoyed it, man.